Hi everyone, I'm Scott Brown, and before we dive into today's lessons I learned in law, I just wanted to tell you about our friends over at Beamery. Beamery is a real game changer in the world of talent management, so HR and talent teams should definitely take note. It is trusted with the likes of Accenture, McKinsey, AstraZeneca and Uber, to name a few. Now, this is a great piece of recruitment technology, which is an AI-powered talent platform that will enable you to hire candidates faster, develop the skills of your existing workforce, and increase employee retention. With Beamery, you'll have a complete understanding of your workforce's skills and capabilities, and it's all about building an agile and future-proof team. So check it out. Head over to their website at beamery.com. Hi, I'm Scott Brown. Thank you for tuning in to Lessons I Learned in Law, the podcast brought to you by Heriot Brown In-House Legal Recruitment. We're specialists in placing lawyers in fulfilling careers in-house. Each week on the podcast, I get to sit down with someone with a connection from the legal profession to talk through and hear about their top three lessons from their career. And I really hope that it will leave you inspired and energised. And this week, I really hope that you'll be left feeling that lawyers can do good as well. I'm honoured to be joined today by Alex Stephanie, who is the founder and CEO of Beam. Hi, Alex.
Hello, how are you doing?
Great, thank you. Thanks for joining me today and taking time out of your busy schedule. For those of you that haven't heard about Beam, then this is your enlightenment moment, and you can thank me for that later. Beam is an award-winning tech for good platform that crowdfunds employment training for homeless people and refugees by supporting them into stable jobs and homes. I'm really excited to hear more about that from Alex later, but since launching in 2017, Beam has raised more than 3.5 million in donations and changing lives for more than 1,000 people, and has won loads of accolades and awards along the way. I've stalked Alex for months to ask him to be a guest on the podcast for a couple of reasons. We're proud partners of Beam, and I'm so happy that he's here to share more about their journey and the journey in his career. But a fact that I think he keeps to himself a little bit is, and he likes to keep it on the down low, is that he's actually a qualified lawyer in a previous life. So, Alex, great to have you today.
Great to be here. I mean, I don't think I keep it on the down low. It's just a long time ago now. So, yeah. You know, every sort of, can I even call myself a lawyer? I think you need to have a practicing certificate and that sort of thing. Like, I've qualified as a lawyer. But yeah, that was my first job out of university. So unfortunately, a while ago now.
Yeah, well, glad to hear it's not completely erased. Yeah, I'm sure it's taught you some things which we're keen to hear about. But before we jump into your lessons, Alex, it would be great if you could, for the benefit of those who don't know about Beam, can you share a little bit about your mission?
Sure. So we are transforming how the world supports those left behind through the power of people and technology. And so when we talk about people left behind, we're talking about people who are homeless, people who are refugees, people who've been in prison. And we're beginning to think about how we can support other groups like people with disabilities to really fulfill their potential. And what that means in practice is we have two services. We have Beam Jobs and Beam Homes. And Beam Jobs is obviously supporting people into stable jobs, and Beam Homes is supporting people into stable homes. So these really, really foundational things that people need. And there have, of course, been many services that support people into jobs and homes for a really long time. But I think what is very different about Beam's approach is that we are tackling these issues as a tech startup, using a lot of technology, product, and data, and using the kind of, I guess, power of startup culture, if you like, that kind of unhierarchical, idea-friendly, experimental culture, to tackle these problems with hopefully some, you know, quite fresh eyes and an awful lot of passion. The way it works in practice is we partner with government. They refer people to the service. We give them a caseworker. We also make sure they have a phone, because this thing here is the greatest invention ever to achieve social mobility and social justice. We give them a phone, and then we deliver services through that phone directly to them, supporting them into a job and a home. The way that the crowdfunding works is that there are obviously financial costs to this. So we go out to the public, both individual people and, of course, firms like your own, and they can get involved by supporting people. That means funding what they need. It could be employment training. It could be a suit for a job. It could be a rental deposit to move into a home, or a fridge for their new home. So the public gets involved and removes all these financial barriers and also sends lots of messages of support. And in some ways, that's the kind of secret sauce behind all of this stuff. It's the fact that people are referred to our service who have been marginalized, let down, struggling, suffering for years, decades, sometimes their whole life. And suddenly they use the technology to connect with hundreds of people who actually care. And they remember that their lives have value, and that can have a really transformative impact on people. That can give them the confidence and the momentum to achieve things that they never thought possible.
Amazing. I'd encourage anyone out there to check out the platform and the stories are, and the way that you guys present that information to people on there is great. You can really feel, you feel a part of it, and you're helping, you're really changing lives. And to be a part of that is, yeah, it's really inspirational from my side. I'm keen to hear as we go along, Alex, I'm sure we'll hear more around the inspiration and having set up Beam back in 2017 along the way. But we'll jump in, if you don't mind, with your first lesson that you've learned in your career, be that law or along the way.
So I think lesson one would probably be, if you can give back, if you have the ability, the opportunity, the privilege of being able to support others and give back, you should. And I think that is a responsibility and an obligation for the lucky few. And I was very lucky in many ways growing up. And I think I was raised with those values. Both my parents are lawyers. And I think that the sense in my family's household growing up was like, we're all really lucky. Like, we have food on the table, we have a roof above our heads, and many people don't. If you are in a fortunate position, you have an obligation to give back. And I think the legal profession has this incredible legacy of giving back and pro bono. And the legal profession should be really, really proud of that. It's taken seriously by law firms in a way that is just not in most sectors, is the simple reality. You know, people lead from the top in law firms that pro bono and work that contributes positively to the communities in which they operate matters, and is not tokenistic. And since really the earliest days of Beam, we've been working with Herbert Smith Freehills, who've been supporting Beam on a pro bono basis and have provided the most phenomenal support to Beam across many different functions of that law firm, from, you know, tax to employee incentives to data and many others. And, you know, I'm so impressed by that commitment that runs through the firm to taking this stuff seriously and believing this stuff really matters. And, you know, I've spoken to, you know, been working with very junior trainees, and I've been talking to the managing global partner, and everyone cares. And I think that is very impressive. And I think the legal profession should be really proud of that. And one of the formative experiences in my life was when I was a trainee working at Clifford Chance. Clifford Chance had a partnership with a legal charity called Law for All. And this legal charity gave advice to anyone about anything. It was incredibly open-ended in its scope. And it was a secondment, so it was part of my training contract. And it was the last 3 months of my training contract. And after my training contract ended, I actually stayed on at this firm. And it was a really formative experience for me, because I'd grown up in London, but, you know, I'd grown up in a kind of, I guess, middle class suburban area. And I was, for 3 months, just coming very face to face with the, I would say, most extreme forms of poverty in London. And I had seen glimpses of that before in jobs I'd been doing. And, you know, I'll try and get out of my comfort zone and, you know, just working in warehouses and things like that to earn money in summer holidays. You know, I wasn't completely blinkered, but I was seeing people who were just struggling to survive. You know, I would remember these legal clinics, would go in the morning, and there were just huge queues stretching around the building, Scott, of people who were waiting to get this free legal advice. And then they would have, I think, 15-minute slots with me. And I was, you know, this trainee lawyer who knew nothing about law, still know nothing about law, but knew nothing then as well. And people would be coming in, and you would be speaking to people who were being, you know, who were physically, you know, a bit at risk, were being abused, assaulted, the government was trying to deport them. They were, of course, completely penniless, had nowhere to go, didn't speak English, you know, health conditions. Just like, often you would see people had many of these problems at once. And it was really tough to be given these 15-minute slots trying to unpick someone who was being, you know, pursued by a violent debt collector and had terrible health issues and all kinds of complex legal issues. And it was, I guess, the kind of experience that's hard to kind of row back from. You're like, once you've seen that stuff, once you've realized that there is so much poverty and there are people with such profound problems in one of the wealthiest cities in the world, it's quite hard to kind of unsee that stuff and unknow that stuff. And I guess the other reflection it left me with is I felt very powerless to actually help these people in a meaningful way. And I was continually thinking, we are actually getting to these people way too late and we need to be way more upstream of these problems and way smarter at stopping them kind of snowballing into these desperately sad situations, you know, at the scale at which they were. And I didn't really know what I could do to address that. I didn't know how I could help. And fast forward a few years, I had built and run a tech company called Just Park. And I learned the basics of how you build a company and build technology. And I guess then my thoughts began to turn back to all of the social impact work and to think, actually, what would happen if you took some of the things that people can do within technology and you applied them to these problems, like homelessness, like the refugee crisis, that have mostly been ignored by tech entrepreneurs and tech investors. The situation we're in today is that if you are a privileged person like you or like me, we have wonderful technology that has cost billions of dollars to build and sits on our phone, and I can book a nice Airbnb or order some sushi to my desk in 15 minutes from Deliveroo. And that's fine. But we have not put 1% of that TLC and human and financial capital into solving problems for people who really, really need help. And if you are a refugee who is sleeping rough on the streets of London tonight, this thing here is no use, really, or very limited use. And if you're a single mom in emergency accommodation with young kids and mold all over your walls, this thing here is of very little use, unfortunately. And I think that's a huge missed opportunity. And that's why one of the things I'm most excited about is how we are beginning to put products onto smartphones that make services far more accessible for people.
Yeah, it's amazing hearing all the stuff around the, well, way back to that training, those training contract days, and obviously was partly responsible for flicking a switch there in you. How does it feel in that situation where you do feel powerless with people coming to you? I guess what sort of things were you trying in that, in those circumstances? And I've never done pro bono stuff through a law firm. What's the advice from the arm?
Yeah, I mean, within the very limited time I had, the goal was always just to try and understand what was happening. You know, you have 50 minutes to get your head around very complex situations, and you want to try and understand as much as you possibly can of these very complex situations in that time and give people some basic common sense steers. And that's very, very hard with the time allowed. And there is such limited provision for people in those sorts of situations that the pressures and on those services were just out of all sync with the capacity of people to deliver them. And of course, this is just wildly different from Clifford Chance, where I was in an incredibly junior role. And, you know, I might be, you know, the third person proofreading this one document on a team of 40 people working on a deal. Like, these were, you know, similar phenomenon that I mentioned before in technology. It's just incredibly well-resourced teams, incredibly well-resourced legal problems that, you know, we were working on. And then you had these very acute legal problems that would just have negligible resource on them.
And yeah, it puts things into perspective as to what's important when you're looking at a big long list of indemnities and that will never transpire, and the resource that's going into that. But yeah, it's great to hear it's been partly behind some of the stuff that you guys are doing. So keen to ask, Alex, like now in your position, there must still be things that you see. You must see so much and be exposed to so much hardship as well. Where are the biggest frustrations? It must be very frustrating in circumstances where it can't help everyone. I guess it's an impossible task.
I guess the main frustration is that for every one person we help, there are hundreds of people that we can't, and that just, you know, gives us the determination to make sure that we can keep growing and scaling and helping more people. And that, I think, keeps us humble as well. You know, my original goal when I started thinking about this, you know, the homelessness problem and how I might be able to get involved or add some value, was I just said to myself, I want to help 1,000 homeless people get jobs. You know, my view is sometimes you just need to pick a number and go for it. And that's what I did. And I had no idea how I was going to do that, but I just picked that number. And then, you know, when was it? Sometime, I think, in the spring, we surpassed that number, summer. And now, you know, of course, we set our sights higher. And now what I think about is we need to actually really move the needle on these social problems. So we need to make sure that when there are graphs of social problems and people in homeless hostels and homeless children and all of these graphs, we need to make those graphs move in the right direction. And I think we can do it. And I think if we keep executing well and we stay focused and we stay humble and we hire great people, we should be able to see that in 2 to 3 years' time in the UK, that these problems are beginning to get solved by a tech startup. And, you know, that's kind of, as you know yourself, like that is the nature of running an organization, you know, whether it's a company or whether it's a nonprofit or whatever it is, like you need to keep setting your sights higher if you're to be successful. And, you know, of course, I'm not achieving anything like these things single-handedly. I am, you know, will soon be 1% of headcount of the team. We're 70 plus people today, we'll probably be 100 by the end of January. So what that means is, you know, that more and more, I just need to think about what's the right strategic direction and work on the, you know, building a really, really strong culture. But, you know, we've come this far because we have a really fantastic team of people who are smart and committed and ambitious. And, you know, this is why, like, for me, it's a very much a cliche, but it's like, it's all about the team. Alex Stephanie is never going to make a difference to homelessness, but, you know, Beam and the Beam team, you know, I hope will.
So we'll move on to lesson two.
Sure. I think lesson two is quite a simple lesson, which is just around attention to detail. So when I joined Clifford Chance, you know, I was just an incredibly scruffy, disorganized, chaotic student. My head was still in like student zone, and even after 2 years of kind of law school, studying more grown-up things, if you like, than studying poetry that I'd been studying before, hadn't really changed that. And I think that at first it grated on me a little bit how everything had to be just right going out the door, but it's actually a very useful thing to learn. And the training contract is kind of like a boot camp in like having high standards, having attention to detail. And I think that serves you really, really well, because you need to have an eye for the detail, I think, to be successful in any role. You need to know when that can become prohibitive and when you need to, you know, think about the big picture. But, you know, one thing that you will consistently find with people who've been through legal training is that attention to detail, that thoroughness, that rigor. And so I think that was a thing that I've taken from it, like the importance of attention to detail and how, you know, people can really get a lot out of, you know, the formal training that professions can give people. And, you know, although I don't really have a great deal of legal knowledge, I think the way in which you approach problems, the way in which you work, and that kind of culture of excellence that you'll find in a really great firm can, you know, teach any young person especially a lot.
Yeah, it's a really good way of putting it. I think gives you that rigor. How do you apply it now? I've spoken to a few people who say, like, knowing when it's good enough, I think, versus that last 10% of making things perfect. How do you, have you found it you've had to filter or act in a different way and forget that training.
Yeah, I think, you know, you always need to think about the impact of the actual work. So tech has lots of good kind of prioritization frameworks that are called the ICE framework, the RICE framework. You know, often there's a sort of, you can do a 2x2 where you're kind of prioritizing kind of impact against ease or effort and things like that. So you always need to be thinking about, like, what is the impact? What is the value in this incremental time or work? But also, you know, you need to also think that, like, standards of excellence are set by people at the top, often in organizations. And that if someone who is running an organization says 7 out of 10 is good enough, and someone they're managing says 6 out of 10 is good enough, and someone they're managing thinks 5 out of 10 is good enough, well, then probably an organization putting 5 out of 10 work out is not going to be particularly successful. If the people at the top say, actually, we want things to be 8 or 9 out of 10 consistently, and they explain to people below them why that is important and necessary, and that becomes part of the culture of excellence, and then I think that organization is going to be more likely to succeed. So some of these things are kind of worth the extra effort because of what they say and how they forge a culture. So, you know, if a logo is, like, you know, in a crazy, not centralized place on a slide deck, that has minimal impact. You know, that has minimal practical impact at all, but that has a cultural impact as well. Because what that says to everyone who looks at it, whether they're internal, external, or is, this is a culture where it's okay to be sloppy. And that has, I think, a really big price.
Very good points. We speak to lawyers all the time that are unfulfilled or not sort of getting their energy from working in the profession and perhaps having ideas about leaving the profession, but maybe not having a framework or an idea as to how to do it. How did you take that step away from the corporate or the corporate world into tech, and what was your journey there?
To be honest, Scott, the answer is very simple, which is that I was a really bad lawyer. So probably one of the worst trainees in the history of Clifford Chance. It really wasn't playing to my strengths. And in that sense, I was lucky because I had my choice made for me. I mean, I remember kind of just seeing everyone doing better than me. But at the same time, I also remember when it came to some tasks, like when we, you know, occasionally they, you know, would sit around and do some kind of idea generation type work. I was generally better than other people. But that was, you know, a few percent of the job. Day to day, there are other people who are just so consistently better than me. And so I just thought, maybe this isn't for me. And I kind of wanted to see that I could reach the top or close to the top of, you know, whatever I was working on. And it was just really quickly obvious to me that that wouldn't be the case. So, you know, I was lucky. I think it's harder for people who, you know, maybe they're not enjoying a role, whether it's law or whatever it is, but they're just very well suited to it. That's really hard because it can, you know, they're being hugely successful, they're being promoted, they're blah, blah, blah. That was never an option for me. Like, I don't think I would ever have been able to become a partner in a top firm. Just don't think my brain's wired that way. So, you know, I was, I think I was lucky.
Yeah, I felt very much the same. I couldn't see a route to that success, and I almost felt like a bit of a failure as a lawyer. But I heard you speaking on another podcast a while ago around getting energy from and ability to work longer hours on stuff that you're energized by in the work that you're doing now, clearly, versus the sort of working in a job where that culture persists.
Yeah, I think that's true. My experience has been, you need to find work that aligns with your values and gives you energy. And I think there's, you know, a very common conversation now around you know, about work-life balance, and work-life balance is very important. But what it misses out is that work is not equal. There is work that really can impair and negatively impact your mental health, your physical health. And there is work that is rewarding, is meaningful, enhances your life, and gives you energy. And if you can find that work, as I have been lucky enough to find, then you're in a very lucky position. But, you know, am I doing better and more happy on a day-to-day basis, but, you know, working really hard doing what I do versus working 10 till 4 p.m. doing something that saps my spirit 100 times over. So, yeah, I think, you know, that's something that sometimes is missing from this work-life balance debate, is that it is a good thing if you find work you are passionate about. And if you find work that you're passionate about and aligns with your values and gives you energy and you're working hard, then I think that's a great thing, actually. And, you know, that's how a lot of progress happens in the world. It's that alignment between people's passions, and they are doing work that they're passionate about. Of course, like, there are limits to that. You don't want to be, you know, working constantly and, you know, to the detriment of your health, even if you do find that. But, you know, it is common for me to work a very long day at Beam and end the day just full of energy.
That's good. Where it doesn't feel like work when you're that passionate about it. That's the
absolutely.
That's the secret sauce. I'm really keen to hear your thoughts on Patagonia and their latest that's been in the news around the trust. What are your, obviously another organization that's doing good, what are your thoughts on that move?
Yeah, I mean, I guess just segueing from what we were saying, you know, like, if you can find work that doesn't feel like work, I mean, that was like, Yves Chouinard, that was his shtick. That was his whole thing when he was building the business. It was just like, why can't work be a group of people having fun, working hard, but just building stuff they want to build and living the lifestyle that they want to have? And so this was a kind of unintentional challenge to corporate America, where a group of kind of renegades, you say, okay, yeah, sure, we'll work when you want to work, and we'll go surfing when you want to surf, and we'll be free, but we are driven by passion, not driven by the stick of the corporate boss saying you must be in this office and you must wear this suit and you must da 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 da. And of course, like, by tapping into the passion of people, he's built this most phenomenal, hugely successful, profitable, large business and an incredible brand. And I think that the reason they've been so successful is because they have taken their values and culture seriously, consistently, and they have therefore built a brand that means something and that people admire. And, you know, what he did the other day by transferring ownership to a trust that will essentially put Patagonia's profits to work on environmental and ecological projects forever is, I think it's just, I kind of almost lost for words. You know, it's just, whatever the social impact or environmental impact equivalent is of, like, playing an absolute blinder in a way that almost maybe no one ever has before. And, you know, part of that was keeping the business private and retaining control. But I mean, I think also part of it was being prepared to be slower. You know, I think the tech industry has this obsession with speed and, you know, making money quickly. It's one reason why people in tech love crypto. And actually getting a business from nothing to a listed business in 5 or 7 years, it might be, you know, wonderful fantasy for venture capitalists, but I don't think you really build many enduring great organizations in such a short period of time. And what he has built with Patagonia is a truly enduring organization. And I think that company will be thriving certainly in 20 years' time, almost certainly, I think, in 50 or 100 years' time, in a way that very few fashion brands will. So, you know, what an incredible achievement. And I think, you know, building, you know, companies are, I think, a little bit like buildings. You know, you can bang them up in 5 years, but that building will not last. But if you build it with real care, real attention to detail, as we were talking about before, real passion, you build it right. You know, like the Romans, they built their buildings right. Go stand under the dome of the Pantheon in Rome. You know, those buildings can last 1,000 years or thousands of years. And I do worry at times today that we treat companies and organizations in general a bit like buildings, and we just throw them up. And then we're surprised that they're not values driven, or they don't stand the test of time, or they, you know, don't treat their employees properly, or they cause pollution and environmental carnage and all of these other things. And I think sometimes we've just got to be prepared to be a little bit more patient.
Yeah.
And, you know, the approach of Beam has been, we're going to build the organization at the right speed. We're going to go at a good rate because we have big problems that we need to, you know, we need to solve reasonably quickly because there are millions of people who are suffering, but we're going to try and do that all sustainably.
Yeah. And I think that for me is the really impressive thing about looking at Beam. It's the numbers, obviously, that you're impacting and helping, but it's the retention, the helping people into jobs, but it lasting, and the percentages that are in and not supported on an ongoing basis by the caseworkers is fantastic, and in that sustainability piece. We'll move on to lesson three.
Lesson three was just, I remember someone who was in charge of litigation at Clifford Chance just had this motto that he used a few times. For some reason, it stuck with me. His name was, I think, Simon Davies. And I remember him saying, impress everyone. And that just sounded like a really ridiculous, strange thing when I first heard it. But I think it is just somehow kind of burnt itself into my brain. And I think it's a bit similar to kind of just do the right thing by everyone. You know, this is a small interconnected world and it's a really, really high yardstick and it's really, really ambitious. But, you know, impress everyone and treat people well. And, you know, whether that is some, you know, quote unquote important person or whether that is someone who, you know, is quote unquote a less important person and they are, you know, the office cleaner, or they're the receptionist, or they're your Uber driver. And, you know, these are really hard things because we're all coming into contact with hundreds of people on a daily basis often. But I think that is something that I try and live. I certainly, you know, often cock things up and I often don't impress people. But I think that is an aspiration that is about really taking pride in how you interact with people and how you treat people. And I think that, you know, that's another thing that like the legal profession does well. It's like people take pride in their work. And, you know, that's the thing that probably lawyers take for granted. But in most companies, in most sectors, that probably isn't true.
Yeah. I think it's great value, great lesson from Simon there at Clifford Chance. It's, I think, so important as well. You never know the connections that come of that as well. But just doing it for treating everyone on even keel is great. So thank you for sharing the lessons, Alex. We're running out of time and don't want to keep you too long. But what can lawyers and law firms do to help Beam and help the mission? What can people out there that are listeners as an individual perhaps do to support you guys?
Everyone, if you're listening to this, please go to the website and just have a look around. It's a very easy website to remember. It's beam.org. And there's a few different ways that you can get involved. So you can do fundraisers like Harriet Brown have done. And it's very simple. You'll know the drill. You start a fundraiser, you put a target, you pass the link round. What's really cool about raising funds through Beam is that it's a 100% giving model where every penny is removing the financial barriers that people are facing. And also on that fundraiser, as that money is distributed to people using the Beam platform, you can actually see those individuals on the fundraising page and you can read their stories and you can see exactly where the money's going on their budget. So it's very efficient and it's very transparent. There's also a feature we have called gift cards where you can actually gift a donation to someone else. So if you are running a law firm or you're partnering a law firm, when people join your firm, you can actually say, we care about social mobility and we've given you a little welcome present. And here is a £20 or whatever donation that you can go to the Beam website and you can actually apply to someone's campaign and invest in someone's future. And those are also really popular over the Christmas period. So instead of people sending out lots of Christmas emails that, you know, let's face it, aren't always wanted, we will get plenty of them already, actually sending a Christmas email with some meaning and some impact where someone can get the email and they can get a little gift card and they can help someone. So those would be some of the ways that law firms can get involved. We are also soon going to be bringing out some, I think, really exciting new technology that will allow law firms to track, and other companies to track their impact much better, to get involved with volunteering, and all kinds of other exciting things, which we're going to be working on for the rest of this quarter and should be coming soon.
Sounds great. I was going to ask around the volunteering piece, because I imagine that was fairly disrupted over the last couple of years. So great to hear that that's on the agenda as well. Well, yeah. If anyone wants to hear more about you guys and follow and track the company, follow on LinkedIn. And is there anywhere else that they can keep up to date with everything that's going on?
Yeah. So on LinkedIn and all the social channels, we're just at We Are Beam.
Awesome. We'll share those links in the podcast bio. But thank you very much, Alex. That's been great to have you join us today, and look forward to Beam's success, and we look forward to help doing our little bit.
Thanks so much, Scott. Have a great day.
Thanks so much, Alex. It's been great to hear your lessons, and thanks for sharing so much information about Beam and its mission. It's really inspiring what you guys do, and everyone in the legal profession, myself and everyone at Heriot Brown, we're all rooting for you at Beam and wishing you all the success and continued success in the future. And guys, if that hasn't left you feeling inspired and a love for what the legal profession can do, then I loved hearing about Alex's pro bono experience when he was at Clifford Chance. It really rung a chord, and people should be proud of what lawyers do in that space. But if it doesn't leave you inspired, then I'm not sure what will. Heriot Brown's been a proud partner of Beam for over a year now, and as we said on the podcast, we gift card for every placement that we make a donation to Beam. As we mentioned whilst speaking to Alex, Heriot Brown has been a proud partner of Beam for over a year now, and it's no surprise to us that we see them going from strength to strength and winning so many awards. They're having a great impact on social mobility and thinking about a lot of problems that exist in our society today. So we're very fortunate to have heard that, and we are all in a very fortunate position. So I hope you can check them out at beam.org and give them a follow and some support. We're delighted to be getting the wheels in motion and organising our second annual General Counsel Burns Night, which takes place in January 2023. All proceeds from the event will go straight to Beam. To find out more about the event, drop us an email at burnsnight@heriotbrown.com, or drop my colleague Emma Bauer a message on LinkedIn, or an email at emma@heriotbrown.com. We'd love to see as many of you there as possible. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, then please go back and check out some of our previous guests in series gone by. There are some amazing lessons shared and lots of inspiration from there. You can search for all the episodes in previous series on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all those other good listening platforms, or head over to heriotbrown.com/podcast. If you've got any feedback or you'd like to appear on the podcast as a guest, then drop me a line at scott@heriotbrown.com, or come and connect with me or Heriot Brown on LinkedIn. Thank you for listening. See you next time.